This is the BBC.
I'm Jim Waterson, the political editor of BuzzFeed UK, presenting this week's edition of Week in Westminster, where we'll discuss abuse in politics, the Great Repeal Bill, the state of the Conservative Party, and how on earth Parliament can hold tech companies to account. There's not much point pretending that it's business as usual in Westminster, so this edition of Week in Westminster won't pretend that all is well in the crumbling Victorian building on the edge of the Thames. As the political world edges slowly towards summer recess, Parliament itself feels creaky, both literally and metaphorically. This week, builders continue to encase the Elizabeth Tower, which holds Big Ben, in scaffolding ahead of urgent repairs to ensure its iconic chimes continue to ring out across the capital. The clock in the tower is described by authorities as being in a chronic state and in need of emergency work to stop it from failing. The same description could apply to the state of British politics. The general election result still casts a shadow over everything in Westminster. It's only a month since the vote, which was called by Theresa May to increase her parliamentary majority, but instead resulted in an embarrassed Prime Minister being forced to form a minority government to lead the country through Brexit negotiations. This week, we're going to discuss how Parliament can rise to the challenge of dealing with some of the biggest issues affecting the future of politics. There's questions about how abuse is impacting the ability of MPs to do their jobs and putting the future diversity of Parliament at risk. We'll ask whether politicians have the technological know-how or ability to regulate the internet. And we'll ask how the Conservative Party could rebuild its support among younger voters. Theresa May herself was busy hosting the King and Queen of Spain on Wednesday, prompting Cabinet Office Minister Damian Green, her effective deputy, to stand in at Prime Minister's questions. Green, whose Twitter biography describes him as a fan of Reading FC and half man, half biscuit, found little in the way of sunshine as he took on Labour's Emily Thornberry.
Is it still the government's clear policy that no deal is an option?
I recommend the Right Honourable Lady read the Prime Minister's Lancaster House speech. That is the basis on which we're negotiating. But we're also saying that it is conceivable that we would be offered a kind of punishment deal that would be worse than no deal. It is not our intention. We want to have a deal. We want to have a good deal.
First, we're going to deal with the government's repeal bill, referred to by some as the Great Repeal Bill. It's technically the European Union Withdrawal Bill, but whatever it's called, it was introduced this week and is set to dominate parliamentary debate after the summer recess. The legislation, which all sides accept is integral to the process of Brexit, transplants existing EU law onto the British statute book. I spoke to Plaid Cymru's Jonathan Edwards, a Remain supporter who is a member of a new cross-party group aimed at limiting the impact of Brexit, from his Carmarthen constituency. I was also joined by Nadeem Zahawi, a pro-Brexit Conservative MP. I began by asking Nadeem how this process would take place.
Well, as we begin the process of coming out of the EU, what we need to do is make sure that British business, British workers, have all the rights and the rules that apply either side. And I would have probably, and I'm sort of, you know, probably speaking out of line here, I would have called it the Great Continuity Bill rather than a Great Repeal Bill, in the sense that if we get this through, it's the best way for us to have the least amount of disturbance, the least amount of flux. This bill will actually deliver that certainty that we basically adopt all EU law and regulation into UK law, and then over time begin to re-examine each and every part to see what works really well for us and what doesn't. Of course, what we want to do, and this is where the other parties, and I'm sure Jonathan will have something to say about this, we want to make sure that all the good things actually are things that are protected under British law as well, including workers' rights.
Jonathan, you're part of a new cross-party grouping which is aiming to at least water down the effect of Brexit. How's that actually going to work? How are you going to work with rival parties on this?
Now, this is the defining issue of our political time. There's clearly a lot of concern about the direction of travel being brought forward by the British government. Now, there's two schools of thought. There's one school of politicians who think that the cavalier approach of the British government is actually going to work. There's some of us who are slightly more sceptical. Now, in that instance, it's vital for those of us who believe that there is a way to secure a more responsible Brexit, and I agree fully with Nadeem, we should be trying to create as much certainty as possible. And for me, that means maintaining our partnership within as many of these vital European frameworks as possible. That's the only way we're going to secure certainty for businesses. We will have to work across the party lines. And what's interesting, of course, is the fact that you've got Jeremy Corbyn supporting Theresa May's extreme Brexit, which means that the splits now are going to be happening around parties. And I think the fact that we're seeing now parliamentarians in the group that we've set up this week willing to work together is a sign of how things will work, especially as this bill is brought forward in the autumn.
Nadeem, there's a tiny majority for the Conservative government backed up by the DUP. How much are you willing to make concessions on, to concede on, in order to make sure that this gets into statute?
Well, I think the most important thing is if we all agree that it is British jobs, British business, that needs this certainty. This bill is for them to feel that actually they can make the investment decisions they need to make, because the rules will apply in the UK are the same rules that will apply in the EU. If we keep that front and centre, then all the other compromises can work. Anything that derails British economy by delay, by playing politics, I think will be looked upon very, very badly by the British people.
Jonathan, a major row in Parliament could cause chaos for Britain. It could cause problems to the economy. Isn't it up to you to just get on with this and find agreement without, you know, drawing it out over months and months and months?
I've been on the Brexit Select Committee, and I've got to be honest, the more I was on that Brexit Select Committee in the last Parliament, the more confused I got about the government's position. You know, it's clear there's been no assessment of the key negotiating lines that they've set out, and I'm far more sceptical of what the British government is doing than I was when I got onto that committee, which is, you'd think it'd be the reverse, wouldn't you, after spending time scrutinising. I think the other very interesting issue around what's going to happen over the next few months is that we're going to learn very quickly that the British state is no longer a unitary state run by Westminster, although that is what the British government are trying to do with this bill, because there's no way in the world that I could foresee the Scottish Parliament and even the National Assembly for Wales giving a legislative consent motion for this bill. And the British government has already conceded that the bill cannot proceed without those motions from the devolved parliaments. There is no way in the world that I can see that parliamentarians in Wales are going to allow the British government to fundamentally rewrite the Welsh Constitution. And I can certainly guarantee you that the Scottish Parliament won't be doing it.
Nadeem, this is leaving no time for any real substantive other government business. This is swamping the parliamentary agenda. This is chaotic. It's messy.
I wouldn't describe it in the words that you've used. I think if political parties, the opposition party and others, play politics with it, they will not be forgiven. I am in no doubt that if the opposition parties begin to frustrate and delay this, it will delay business decisions. This is the first building block, i.e. the ability for British business and European business to do business across the UK and Europe in the same way, same rules. I would just urge my colleagues to think long and hard and be careful what you wish for if you start playing politics with this bill.
Jonathan?
Well, I think the problem with that argument, of course, is that Theresa May, as Prime Minister, has played politics with Brexit in holding the general election. You know, she initiated the Article 50 process so that the negotiations could begin, and then they got derailed by 2 months. And that is why, partly why we're in this complete shambles. We've got the summer recess now. The clock is ticking. If it wouldn't have been a general election, we'd have been discussing the Great Repeal Bill now.
Jonathan Edwards and Nadeem Zahawi there, discussing the parliamentary challenge of the Brexit bill. But what about the state of politics in general? One of the most important debates of this week saw MPs from all parties debate the abuse they've received and the impact it's having on them, their staff and political activists. Some of the abuse described in the Westminster Hall debate came from anonymous posts on social media. Some of it was shouted at MPs in the street. And some bordered on violence. Shadow Home Secretary Diane Abbott stood up to describe what she had endured. Here are some of the less offensive comments.
We are talking about mindless abuse. And in my case, the mindless abuse has been characteristically racist and sexist. And just to outline, I've had death threats. I've had people tweeting that I should be hung if, quotes, they could find a tree big enough to take the fat bitch's weight. There was an EDL-affiliated Twitter account, hashtag burn Diane Abbott. I've had rape threats.
And that's some of the less offensive comments. But where does the line between the rough and tumble of political debate and abuse start and begin? Is regulating online political discourse necessary, or should we stand for free speech at all costs? And is this just a societal problem, symptomatic of an increasingly polarised political world, where anger at real-world issues spills over into political discourse? I invited Conservative MP Simon Hart, who called the debate, and the SNP's Lisa Cameron into the studio to discuss. Why precisely had Simon felt the need to call this debate?
It's not about MPs who are just feeling a bit sorry for themselves. It's the effect it's had on families, on volunteers, on donors, on just members of the public. People who want to be part of the political process now think, I daren't do this, I daren't support one party or another, because all it's going to result in is a whole load of nonsense being thrown at me from whichever angle. And we're driving people away from engaging in politics at a time the opposite should be happening.
Lisa, what's your experience of abuse in politics? How does that actually affect you as an MP?
It affected me pretty much as soon as I was elected in 2015. I went overnight from being a doctor who felt very well respected within the community to all of a sudden having to deal with abuse on Twitter, on Facebook, etc. And I think during the past election, there was definitely a rise in terms of the level of vitriol that I experienced, and also my staff. Actually, only last week, someone was arrested by the police for threatening our office. So I think we must take it seriously.
So, Simon, what's actually changed in the last 2 years? I mean, we had the EU referendum. Is it a schism like that? In Scotland, we saw a lot of abuse around the Scottish referendum on independence in 2014. Is it a big schism like that which causes this?
I think the EU referendum got bitter and personal. The Scottish referendum got bitter and personal. I think what we witnessed in the Trump campaign, in a sense, almost fueled this particular situation. But I think social media has got a huge part to play in this. And the relative silence from the social media platforms and unwillingness to do anything about this story, even where there are flagrant examples of lawlessness, the social media companies appear to be looking the other way. And the other thing is political leadership. Actually, if political leaders stood up and, rather than just sort of make mealy-mouthed comments about this, said, not in our name, if anybody does this in our name, they will have no place in this party. Until they do that, they're sort of giving permission by another means. Now's a good moment for them to stand up and universally condemn this, because if they don't, it's going to get worse.
I mean, I think you're referring there to Jeremy Corbyn, leader of Labour, the opposing party. He has repeatedly said that he does not want this done in his name, that he does not want abusiveness in his party. But there's been quite a move by some Conservative MPs to pin this as a left-wing problem.
I think there is plenty of evidence of left versus right, and there is some evidence of right versus left as well. But I think the Corbyn example is an interesting one, because despite what he said, has there been a single member of the Labour Party or Momentum or anything else which has actually been who's actually been expelled as a result of this activity? I don't know. And actually, when there was a protest the other day in Parliament and there were people wearing support Jeremy Corbyn T-shirts, holding banners of the bleeding head of the Prime Minister on a stake, that was an opportunity to say, not in my name. But he didn't take that opportunity. To me, that is demeaning politics. Not demeaning Theresa May, but it is demeaning politics.
Lisa, where does the line cross? I mean, maybe some people would say that sort of pastiching the Prime Minister is just part of the same political debate that we've had for hundreds of years, that, you know, this is just a slightly more extreme, modernised version of satire and the way that that has played itself out.
I mean, I think the lines have become very blurred for some people, and I think that's why it's important that we do draw distinct boundaries and make sure that people know that it's not okay to bully, to harass and to abuse, to engage in anti-Semitic or other types of racist or bigoted remarks. There are definite steps that we can take to say that politics should be welcoming to all and that all points of views will be respected, and I think that would be a great step forward, because we need to have diversity in politics, particularly at Westminster.
Simon, one of the arguments put forward by some campaigners, particularly anti-Conservative campaigners online, is that sort of these words and the campaigns against Conservative MPs on social media are justified because of the impact that the Conservative government is having on some people in society. They view this as a just war, another means of fighting the government when they're out of power. Do you think there's any truth in that?
I think there's probably some truth, and that's the claim they make. Is it legitimate? No, it isn't. I think there is a vast difference between legitimate political campaigning, holding the government to account, challenging its decisions, but actually running an online campaign against candidates based, for example, on accusing them of being subject to a police investigation for fraud when they've never been anywhere near a police investigation for fraud, allowing that to run throughout an election campaign in order to convince the public that this person isn't fit for public office. That is absolutely not okay. And it's even more outrageous that the social media platforms which enabled it turn around and say it's within regulations, so we're not going to take it down. Legitimate protest, yes. absolutely scurrilous accusations, no.
Lisa?
Companies really do bear a responsibility for that, particularly when comments are abusive, particularly if they're defamatory, etc. I don't even have an awareness, really, of how to contact the person in charge at an opportune moment to make sure that they're aware of comments and what to do with those in, you know, social media platforms. So information like that would be helpful, but also a way forward in terms of what they're going to do and how they'll take responsibility for those platforms.
Lisa Cameron and Simon Hart there, discussing their fears that future politicians could be put off by the level of abuse. We like to ask big questions on Week in Westminster, and the regulation of the internet is one of the few non-Brexit topics which the government is committed to dealing with. The Queen's speech promised a new digital charter to ensure the safety of Britons online, but what this actually means is up for debate. It also raises questions about the impact that global tech companies, especially Facebook and Google, are having on our society. Can Parliament take on the power of these tech giants when they're registered abroad? And are politicians even up to the task of understanding the technological issues involved? Conservative MP Damien Collins is the newly re-elected chair of the Digital Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee, which until this month was simply the Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee, while Louise Hague is the new Shadow Policing Minister, but previously spent 2 years covering digital policy for Labour. I began by asking Damien Collins how politicians could take on these tech companies.
There are levels that you work through on something like this. So with a lot of the technology companies, there's been progress made on combating pirated content online. That's not been done with, in statute, in law, but getting the companies around the table and saying, you have got an obligation to stop people ripping off the copyright of other people's material through your search engines or through your platforms, and we expect you to take action against it. I think with things like, you know, fake news and illicit material, messages of hate, again, you know, we expect the social media companies to act against that content, to take it down as they have done pirated content. Now, the question comes, if we get to a point where they just refuse to cooperate, then what do we do then? And I think then we should look at the idea of a law which says, if a company has content referred to it that's in breach of its own community guidelines and in breach of decent standards, that it should act to take it down. And if it fails to do that, then it could be fined or face some other sanction. And that's certainly the route that has gone down in Germany. You've got to do more to combat this material, and that's what we want to see.
It's not just about extremism, it's not just about illegal material, it's about imposing many of the same moral standards and laws that exist in the offline world onto tech companies, which have basically been allowed to do what they want for about 10 years.
Well, obviously the tech companies have said, well, we're not publishers, this isn't our content, it's user-generated. But they create the space in which this content is used and shared, and therefore they have a responsibility to police their own social networks, particularly when they're in breach of their own community guidelines. Now, the companies are saying they're putting more resource in place to make sure they can deal with user-generated content. But I think that there should be some sense of obligation upon them, and ultimately the threat of some form of government sanction if they refuse to do it.
Luhe, do you think that the government and Parliament as a whole has left it a bit late to understand the scale of what's happened in terms of the effect that these companies, mainly Facebook and Google, are having on society as a whole?
Yeah, I find this debate very frustrating at this stage of my, you know, second term as an MP. The UK Council on Child Internet Safety, for example, has been sitting there for almost 10 years and has done absolutely nothing to do what Damien's saying absolutely should happen now, to bring companies round the table to make sure that they are being responsible about the kind of content that is being shared on their platforms. Now, there were two major pieces of legislation in the last Parliament, the Investigatory Powers Act and the Digital Economy Act, and both of those presented major opportunities to tackle issues around terrorism that are promulgated on the internet and issues around, for example, online bullying and child protection. And the government ignored those issues and preferred to take the voluntary approach. And it's only in a knee-jerk response to the horrific acts over the last 3 months that they're now saying, right, OK, now's the time to clamp down on technology and the internet. You know, it is an interesting philosophical debate about how the internet should be regulated, and it needs to be done with time and care.
Do you think enough politicians understand the technology to be able to do that? I mean, we had the Home Secretary, Amber Rudd, talking about necessary hashtags and things like that, which is not really a term that anyone in the tech industry even knew what she was on about.
No, I think she was trying to refer to hashings, which is the technology that underpins images that are shared online. But yeah, that was a very revealing interview from the Home Secretary, who clearly, at the time at least, did not have a grip of a brief. And again, it was a very knee-jerk reaction about end-to-end encryption technology in response to the Westminster attack, when actually that Westminster attack was about the least technological attack you could have made. All you needed was a car and a knife. So the last thing we need to do is respond in the way governments are often tempted to do.
The government did accept amendments to the Digital Economy Economy Act just before the election to create a code of practice for social media companies, I think principally looking at cyberbullying and the spread of illicit material.
But that was because the Home Office explicitly blocked our amendments on child protection and anti-terrorism.
But the government accepted the amendment.
So
I think the key thing now is what is included within the code of practice. Mm. That could be the basis of developing some really important legislation in this parliament. With end-to-end encryption, I think one of the reasons that came up around the Westminster attack, Louise is right to say that was a very low-tech attack, but the attacker sent a message from WhatsApp just before he carried the attack out. I think there is a legitimate public debate here to say if people are using encrypted messaging to plan attacks, then what right should the government have to be able to read it?
Most of these companies are based on the west coast of America. I mean, there's very little that the British government, it can huff and it can puff, but there's not a lot it can do about actually making them change their ways. How can Parliament, sovereign Parliament, even do anything about this?
Well, I think that's why you have to take, as Damien said, a two-stage approach of getting them around the table, but ultimately having that backstop power to legislate should the need arise. But I have to say, you know, I do find some of this a bit of almost a deliberate red herring, because in that instance, in the Westminster attack, the message was sent minutes before the attack was made, and he wasn't under surveillance by the intelligence service. And quite frankly, a large issue in policing counter-terrorism at the moment is purely down to resources.
This point on the encrypted messaging systems is important if we're investigating, was someone a lone attacker or were they part of a cell of people that were working together?
Yeah.
And therefore the ability to see and read messages that they share, you know, if someone's under surveillance is important. So I think it is a very important part of the debate.
And I think we need more transparency over reporting and how Facebook and other platforms respond to reports and complaints, because at the moment we don't know how much content they're taking down. They don't tell us how quickly they do take it down. And we know from recent investigations that they failed to remove even terrorist content reported to them. Parliament needs to take some time and some care in debating these issues. They need to get the experts in, not just the companies, but those that have been lobbying around it.
Are you hopeful that they'll do that?
Well, we've seen Theresa May issuing a call for cross-party working, so I'd be delighted to work with her on it.
Damien, what's your hopes for this? Will you be looking to call the heads of Google and Facebook over to appear at your committee? Can we see Mark Zuckerberg in front of a select committee?
Whether it's live or, you know, or streamed or however it's done, we would love to have Mark Zuckerberg give evidence, but we haven't got to that stage yet.
Damien Collins and Louise Haig on how politicians are grappling with the internet. Talk to many Conservative MPs following the general election and you'll find them in a state of shock after the party went backwards in terms of seats. Several are asking what the Tories can do to compete with a surge in youth support for Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party, and fear that the party's policies, their approach to the media, and their method of campaigning simply don't appeal to a younger generation. They quake at the thought of Labour supporters' momentum, and there's a growing belief among some Tory MPs that the party needs to change fast if it wants to avoid a structural decline and stand a chance of winning the next general election outright. But what can be done? Tom Tugendhat is the Remain supporting newly elected chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, while Sir Craig Oliver was David Cameron's Director of Communications during the 2015 election and the EU referendum campaign. I asked Tom whether there's anything the Conservatives could do to win back younger voters.
The party's facing what every political leader in this country is facing, which is the need to evolve and change according to the demographics and the situation we face ourselves in. And today, one of those striking changes is to do with home ownership and share ownership. I mean, what's really noticeable, perhaps, for me, is that not only is home ownership down, but actually so is share ownership. And the reason this matters, of course, is because if you have a stake in society, whether that stake is a share in the company that you own or a share in a business that you've invested in, then your attitude to the future is going to be different.
Craig Oliver, you worked at the top of David Cameron's Downing Street operation. How does this election compare to how you planned going into the 2015 general election?
From around February 2011, there was a real plan put in place, which was based around the idea that David Cameron's a liberal conservative. How could he possibly win a majority? And there was a huge amount of research done into the country, the seats that were winnable, and then communication with those people that were specifically being targeted. Last election was actually, it was called very late in the day. There wasn't a real understanding of where the electorate was at that point, and a lot of assumptions were made. And I think a particular issue was the failure to communicate effectively on social media, which I think that Jeremy Corbyn's party did do very effectively.
So, Tom, how on earth do you appeal to those young voters who came out in their masses to vote for Jeremy Corbyn in the last election? How do you convince them in the future to consider voting Conservative?
I think Craig made some very good points about thinking strategically about how you engage with voters, and I think he's also right about social media. But of course, both of those two things rely on the policies being right. And what we've got to do fundamentally is explain to people very clearly the simple truth that you can spend yourself into oblivion if you choose to, but the reality is that is the project for disaster. And so what that would be is young people picking up fantastically huge debts off their grandparents and off their parents, and that's simply unfair. We've got to set out an agenda that explains properly why fiscal conservatism, fairness is another word for it, is responsible, why it is fair to kids that you don't indebt yourself and then hand over the bill to them.
Craig, do you think the Conservative Party for too long has relied on the fact that the majority of newspapers by circulation in this country are very supportive of it, that it's relied on old ways of getting its message across and there hasn't been enough thought about the next generation who frankly aren't reading these things?
I think the first thing is in 2015, we did take social media incredibly seriously and in the years running up to that. But we spent a lot of time persuading my boss, David Cameron, look, you need to be a voice in this space and you also need something to say. And I think it's good to hear Tom talking about thinking about how do you communicate with young people. But there's a kind of negative message there, which is absolutely right. And I agree with fiscal conservatism. We can't spend money today that we're going to need for tomorrow. But you also need to offer them something positive.
Of course. But, you know, what I meant was there are huge opportunities in this economy. Look, the internet has changed the economy in ways that are almost unimaginable. So the young person today is doing something that people in my generation and yours, Craig, would never have done. The opportunities for today's economy are enormous. And to show them that actually the Conservative Party, which is the party, as you know, Craig, of entrepreneurs, of ideas and opportunity, has been trying to set out this conservative agenda.
Craig, is there a risk that despite being the party of government, the Conservatives are entering a sort of structural decline at this moment?
There is definitely that real danger. And I think what Theresa May and other senior leading figures in the Conservative Party need to say is, look, while you're dealing with this huge issue of Brexit, make sure that there is a team that is properly going out there, coming up with the ideas, researching the country, and making sure that the Conservative Central Office is actually battle fit. So while everybody in government is focused on Brexit, there needs to be a team that is really, really focused on how does the Conservative Party win the next election.
So if there's one policy which both of you were thinking that is a one thing that could get younger voters back involved with the Conservative Party, somehow get those votes across from Jeremy Corbyn despite the enormous youth support for him, what would that one policy be, Tom?
Well, for me, it's about sharing of assets. And
what do you actually mean by that?
What I mean by that is, do you have a stake in society? Do you have a share in the business that you work in? Do you share in the profit of the labour that you try and make with your fellow team members, whether that team is, you know, two of you doing a startup or 2,000 of you working in Tesco's? Have you got a stake in that business? Because if you don't share the asset class in that way, what you're actually doing is you're putting in your 8 hours, you're getting 8 hours out, and somebody else is not just getting 8 hours out, they're getting the combination out. So it's 8 plus 8 actually doesn't end up making 16. It ends up making quite a lot more.
Craig, what would you be advising Theresa May's team to be concentrating on?
Housing, and specifically, how do you help young people afford to buy a home, and how do you encourage older Conservative supporters to make sure that they realise the importance of that? Because it's all very well being a Conservative supporter, but if you can't persuade young people to vote for you, the party's going to have a limited shelf life.
So Craig Oliver and Tom Toggenhat there on what Conservatives need to do to stand a chance of winning over the next generation of voters. Well, that's enough for me on a political world in crisis. I'm off to wander around Westminster before Parliament breaks up for the summer recess. Next week, Steve Richards is here to look back over an extraordinary few months in Westminster. Thank you for listening. I've been Jim Watson, political editor of BuzzFeed UK.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.